Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the FDA's decision on Friday not to allow Pfizer to offer COVID booster shots for Americans 16 and older, but instead to make them available to those 65 and older, as well as to frontline medical workers and to people who have compromised immune systems. Joining us with a criticism of the FDA's decision is William Hazeltine, Chair and President of Access Health International, who was a professor at Harvard Medical School and Harvard School of Public Health, whose latest book is A Family Guide to COVID and a recently updated version of Variants, the Shape-Shifting Challenge of COVID-19. We'll discuss his article at CNN, The COVID Crisis is Sneaky, Booster Shots Can Protect Us from It, and how the potency of Pfizer wears off, although not so much with Moderna, and that we should prepare ourselves for annual or semi-annual COVID vaccines in the years to come. Then we'll look into the August 29th drone strike in Kabul, which killed an aid worker and 9 members of his family, including 7 children. After calling it righteous, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs had to apologize, along with the head of CENTCOM, and we will speak with Rachel Stoll, Vice President for Research Programs at the Stimson Center, who focuses on the international arms trade and children in armed conflict. She joins us to discuss her latest report, A New Agenda for U.S. Drone Policy and the Use of Deadly Force, and how the damage done to U.S. national security during the Trump years is far from repaired. Then finally, following Friday's virtual meeting with leaders from the UK, EU, Argentina, Bangladesh, Indonesia, South Korea, and Mexico, in which President Biden called for a 30% cut in methane emissions by the end of the decade, we will speak with Joe Von Fischer, a professor of biology at Colorado State University. He works with Google Street View cars to measure the leakage rate of this potent global warming gas from urban systems around the country to find that 6 times more methane is leaking than what the EPA has found. This in addition to leakage from agriculture, fracking, abandoned wells, 2 million miles of pipelines, and household gas stoves and water heaters.
And before we go to our first guest, now that I have resigned in protest from Pacifica and its Los Angeles station KPFK, we have moved fully to online broadcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where we will be depending upon you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program alive during the critical years ahead in which the fate of American democracy will be decided. For those of you who can, help us keep delivering a daily briefing so that those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate can also join in the fight against disinformation, whether it comes from Mar-a-Lago or Moscow. We must win the political warfare battles underway and fight with weaponized facts to save our democracy as we create a reality-based community in post-truth America.
And joining us now is William Hazeltine, who's the Chair and President of Access Health International Incorporated, as well as Chairman of the Hazeltine Foundation for Science and the Arts. With a prolific career in science, business, and philanthropy around the world, he was a professor at Harvard Medical School and the Harvard School of Public Health, as well as he's known for his pioneering work on cancer, HIV, AIDS, and genomics. And he's founded more than a dozen biotechnology companies, including Human Genome Sciences, and serves on the advisory boards of numerous international entities, from the Brookings Institution to the Council on Foreign Relations, and is the author of a number of books, the latest of which is A Family Guide to COVID, and he has a recently updated version of his book, Variants, the Shape-Shifting Challenge of COVID-19, and he has an article at CNN, The COVID Crisis is Sneaky, Booster Shots Can Protect Us from It. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Hazeltine.
Well, thank you for that generous introduction.
And on Friday, the FDA ruled against Pfizer giving booster shots to 16-year-olds and older, and instead they agreed to an alternative proposal to vaccinate those 60 and older along with frontline medical workers and those with compromised immune systems. Do you think that caution is warranted?
No, I don't. I think this is a decision that the scientists involved will come to regret. This is a distinct chance to get ahead of the pandemic for once. We have minimized the danger of SARS-CoV-2 from the outset. The decision not to allow a third shot or not to approve a third shot for those over 15 is, I think, a really serious mistake. It's a mistake because the current data shows that the potency of the vaccines wanes, and it wanes relatively quickly. Now, I understand that the data that shows that the incidence of serious disease and death is not strong at this point. But if we look at examples of other viruses we know, and we look at the course of natural infections, particularly in places which have been heavily infected before by a previous wave, India or Manaus, Brazil, for example, we see that prior infection does not protect against very serious disease and death. In fact, there are about estimates now 3 to 4 million people in India died, and many people in Manaus died during the subsequent waves of infection there. So I think the fact that we know natural infection doesn't protect against serious disease and death, we know now that the vaccines are waning in their potency, I think is a really serious indication that we do need a third shot. The other issue that I'm concerned about is that in this case, it's not the administration that is slowing down our response to the SARS-CoV-2 crisis. It's the scientists. The administration, our president, has done everything he can to make sure we do get a third shot. And now it's over caution. Why do they think it's okay to approve it, a third shot for people over 65 and not worry about safety, but not for people under 65 is a mystery. I think in this case, it's scientists being overcautious and maybe a little bit pushed out of shape because they thought that the administration got the cart before the horse. But this is no time for petty quarrels. This is a very serious issue. And I think it represents our one really good chance to get ahead of this pandemic.
Well, your article concludes, the article at CNN concludes, that in the end, the major determinant of our ability to control COVID-19 is human behavior, not the behavior of the virus itself. And it seems to be that, well, there's a kind of madness afoot in our country where you could turn the Declaration of Independence on its head, where liberty now threatens life and the pursuit of happiness. How did this happen?
That's a very complex question. But it has happened. It's disastrous to see that our country is probably the most seriously affected by COVID, and it's the country that has the most expertise in the world to control COVID. What particularly upsets me is to understand that some parts of the world, China in particular, a country of 1.4 billion people with very broad, big borders and massive cities, has virtually no deaths. Maybe you can two dozen deaths in the last 15, 16 months as compared to 600,000 in the United States. That just shows you how bad the programs that we are managing are. They're terrible. And it's just distressing as can be. Particularly distressing for me because I was involved with the Harvard School of Public Health in programs in which we helped and teach the Chinese health establishment how to control pandemics. After SARS, they came to Harvard, Harvard School of Public Health. I'm currently the head of the U.S.-China Healthcare Summit that arose from that program. And for 10 years, they sent their top leadership, including their Minister of Health, to Harvard to look at what could be done. And they've just implemented the playbook and we haven't. It's really distressing.
Well, we now in the United States, we have a situation where 1 in 500 will die from COVID. And the number actually at this point is about 664,000 deaths. So it's always been a race from the beginning, hasn't it, William Hazeltine, between vaccination and the mutation of the virus?
Well, it's a little more complicated than that, but I don't think that vaccinations alone are ever going to be the answer. They haven't been to flu, and this is behaving, for all the world we can tell, like the flu. It's evolved over time to reinfect previously infected and immunize animals, whether people or other animals. That's what they do in bat caves, and that's what they're doing to us. So the virus can go into your body, suppress your first line of defense, which is your innate immunity. And even if you have memory, it can get in and get out and cause damage before even the memory response can kick in. What works for most vaccines is they're slow enough and they're not tricky enough to shut down the innate immune system long enough to get out. That's why memory works. Memory isn't working so well for this virus, and it doesn't work very well for influenza either.
So I don't know whether you could call it a problem with the mRNA vaccinations, but their potency does wane. And of course, the Israeli Ministry of Health found out in August that almost 60% of those hospitalized in Israel with COVID were vaccinated. So address that, if you will, William.
Well, that's just what I was saying, that it's not a problem with the particular type of vaccine. It's the virus has evolved to be able to reinfect people who have already been infected. Now, we knew that a year ago from data from China. They showed very definitively that natural immunity waned and people could be infected. That was reinforced with the terrible epidemic in Manaus. Manaus, almost everybody had been infected in the first wave, and there was massive infection and death in the second wave. And now there's a third wave there. So vaccines can't do better than nature. They just don't do better than nature. What if nature gives you good long-term protection, then vaccines often give you good long-term protection. If nature doesn't, the vaccines don't either. And that's because the virus has evolved to reinfect people who've already been infected. And I've just written about a 10-part, 12-part series, it's gonna be a 20-part series, on how it does it. We're understanding how it does it now. That understanding will help us get new ways to prevent and treat disease. But it's not a matter of one vaccine or another. It's a matter of the fundamental processes of the virus.
But isn't there the major factor of the fact that when you talk about nature, the virus has not been in nature in a sense because of either a zoonotic leap or a lab accident? This is something that the human body has not evolve protection for over millennia. This is something that just popped up, right?
Well, not exactly. You know, humans have been infected by coronaviruses for a long, long time. We even have built into our immune defenses sort of a defense against coronaviruses. If you look deeply into the first antibodies that humans make, it looks like we have been prepared for this for our deep ancestral origins. The cold-causing coronaviruses do infect us. They infect us every year, like our cold. There are cold viruses. There are four of them. And the same virus can come back and get you again and again and again, no matter whether you've been infected before. So it's not a matter that we are a new population. That is one of the issues at the very beginning. But by now, many of us have been infected. And as we've seen, there are big populations that can get reinfected, get sick, and die from this virus. So it's, and if you actually look at its deeper origin back in the bat caves, bats live a long time. And if this virus weren't able to reinfect bats that had already been infected, it wouldn't be around. It's like, why is flu still around? Because it can reinfect us. Even though we've been infected many times, I've been vaccinated many times, and no matter how many times I've been infected or vaccinated, in my lifetime, I've gotten five bad cases of influenza. And I think that this virus is going to be pretty similar. We have to have a multi-layered strategy. We can't rely on vaccines. We can't rely on our antiviral drugs only. We have to rely on every tool we've got, which includes identification, contact tracing, and isolation, like China has done. They have really written the book on how to control this pandemic. Now that they're vaccinating as well, they're going to have a much better leg up than the rest of the world.
And again, I'm speaking with William Hazeltine, who's the chair and president of Access Health International Incorporated, and he's a former professor at Harvard Medical School and Harvard School of Public Health. And he's the author of a number of books, the latest of which is A Family Guide to COVID. And he has a recently updated version of his book, Variants, The Shape-Shifting Challenge of COVID-19. And he has an article at CNN, The COVID Crisis is Sneaky, Booster Shots Can Protect Us from It. So when you talk about the comparisons between COVID and the flu, I mean, I just got a flu shot, as a matter of fact, but it's hit or miss, isn't it? I mean, how would you compare then the hit or miss nature of flu shots to the more effective COVID inoculations, Pfizer and Moderna?
Well, I think there we're going to be a little luckier. Flu changes a lot faster than the coronaviruses. And from the data that I've seen, the recently published data, the third shot really gives you much higher protection. Actually, I believe that this should have been a three-shot vaccine from the get-go, because the first shot does something, second shot does a lot, the third shot does a lot more, and that's pretty typical of a lot of vaccines. Look at the hepatitis B vaccines, you look at the human papillomavirus vaccines. You wait about 6 months after the first two shots to give the third shot, and you get much better results. It's not going to protect you forever, but I think that our boosters are going to be more effective for longer than the first two shots. I think that's good news. But just like influenza, eventually the effectiveness of the vaccines will wane, and we're going to need another shot, whether that's semi-annually or annually. I think that's what we're going to look forward to. And that's going to give us some protection. But as I say, with this virus, it looks like we're going to need more multi-layered protection. We're going to need antiviral drugs that are prophylactic. We're going to need to change our behavior so when this is peaking, we do whatever we can from a behavioral point of view to minimize it. And we get it out of the political realm and put it back into the public health domain where it belongs.
Well, recently, William Hazeltine, the top official in the World Health Organization, likened the idea of rich nations like the United States having third booster shots to hoarding life jackets while the rest of the world is drowning. And of course, it's pretty clear that this virus doesn't respect borders between states or countries. And until there's a global solution, it will always be around, surely.
It's going to be around whether it's a global solution or not. But I would say the analogy of hoarding life jackets is not exactly right. The first life jackets that have been issued have holes in them, and you'll sink anyway. So what's happening is they're issuing a better life jacket so people can survive. I'm very sympathetic to the issue that this is a problem of inequity on a global scale, but it's got a long history, and it's got a long history of neglect of public health in many of the self-same countries that are now crying for vaccines. You know, this is not unanticipated, but there's huge, the entire continents that don't have capacity to make their own vaccines. How can that be when we know vaccines are so essential for health? All of Africa, you can count on less than the fingers of one hand their countries and facilities for making vaccines. South America, same thing. How can that be? It should have been taken care of a long time ago. And most countries have underinvested in health. The same countries that are crying for more vaccines now, yes, we should do what we can. But if you're the leader of a country, your first and foremost responsibility is to take care of your own people. And that means revaccinating those people who are at risk of dying if they don't get another vaccine. That's what you'll do. You should, of course, make as many vaccines as possible. That's what we are doing in the United States, and I hope other countries are too. And making those vaccines available at a very low affordable cost or free to those who can't afford it. But this should be a wake-up call
to those countries that have neglected their public health and their health infrastructure. For the last 15 years, I've been working to help countries around the world improve health systems and health infrastructure. And it's a real struggle to get the attention in many countries of the leaders who would rather spend the money on some other issue than health. And it's been a big and persistent problem. And this is just highlighting that problem.
And I guess India is a case in point because it's the world's biggest manufacturer of vaccines. Yet I think that there's only about 6% of the population has been vaccinated.
And well, that's changing very fast. Uh-huh. Indians are now vaccinating people at an enormous clip.
Right. The Delta originated there, didn't it?
Excuse me?
The Delta variant originated there, did it not?
It is very likely to have originated there, that's right, and then spread around the world. And they had a terrible time with it. The most conservative estimate is 400,000 people died. A more realistic estimate is something like 2 to 4 million died. It's been a terrible problem. I have offices in India, and one of our young men died. And the relatives of many of our people in India have died of COVID. It's been a terrible problem there.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, William Heseltine, back to the notion that we need to do what the Chinese have done, which is quarantine. Of course, quarantine's been around for millennia. And I guess New Zealand would be the other example, although it has the advantage of being an island nation. Australia has tried it both ways and with mixed results. It doesn't seem like the United States culturally and politically is capable of that kind of discipline.
It takes not only leadership, it takes a people that are willing to say, I am willing to restrict my, I'm willing to put restrictions on what I do to help others because I know they'll do the same for me. That's basically the contract. You know, it's like drunk driving. We don't drive when we're drunk. We don't speed even if we're in a hurry. we shouldn't speed anyway if we're in a hurry. To protect not just ourselves, to protect others. So there are many, many cases where we, examples of restraining our own behavior to help others. But in this particular case, it doesn't seem we're willing to do it. We do it, you know. Americans pull together in disasters in very positive ways. I've seen it happen in 9/11 and hurricane disasters. This one's a really peculiar one that it got politicized in a really unfortunate way. I think a way that's not necessarily typical of everything that we do in this country. So I'm hoping that over time people will come to their senses and realize this isn't political, this is health, and we all have to pull together.
Well, you know, some people blame Trump, and I think there's a good reason to blame him for this thing getting out of hand and certainly politicizing it. But even Trump himself at a rally recently suggested that people should get vaccinated, and he got booed. So it seems like this whole thing is metastasized in a scary kind of way.
It definitely has. And once the snowball gets rolling down the hill, it just gathers momentum, and it's tied into a lot of other issues. But as I say, fundamentally, this is a health issue. There are a number of things we can do. The most positive thing when you think about humanity as a whole is we do have the tools to control it. Humans can fight this. This isn't an automatic death sentence for all of humanity. We can organize ourselves and protect ourselves. And we can do that with our medicine. We can do that with our vaccines. And we can do that with our social structures. And that's a good lesson for humanity. It turns out not all countries can do that, but at least one-fifth of humanity can.
Well, William Heseltine, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
And again, I've been speaking with William Heseltine. He's the chair and president of Access Health International Incorporated. He was previously a professor at Harvard Medical School and Harvard School of Public Health. And he's the author of a number of books, the latest of which is A Family Guide to COVID. And he has a recently updated version of his book, Variants, The Shape-Shifting Challenge of COVID-19. And he has an article at CNN, The COVID Crisis is Sneaky. Booster shots can protect us from it.
We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the August 29 drone strike in Kabul, which killed an aid worker and 9 members of his family, including 7 children.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Rachel Stoll, who's a Vice President for Research Programs at the Stimson Center, where she focuses on issues relating to international arms trade, including small arms and light weapons, as well as children and armed conflict. She's the author of The International Arms Trade and Beginner's Guide to the Small Arms Trade, and the co-author of the report Recommendations and Report from the Stimson Task Force on U.S. Drone Policy, and a recent report, A New Agenda for U.S. Drone Policy and the Use of Lethal Force. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rachel Stoll.
Thanks, Ian. Glad to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And both the head of CENTCOM, General McKenzie, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Milley, have apologized. I'm not sure exactly to the survivor or the father of the number of Afghans. The whole family, in fact, got wiped out by a drone strike, including 7 children and 9 members of the family in total, died on August the 29th in the strike, thinking that, of course, it was an ISIS bomber. But it turned out to be an aid worker who actually works for a company out here in California, in Pasadena, the Nutrition and Education International Foundation, a nonprofit. So this is a terrible embarrassment and, of course, a terrible tragedy for this Afghan family. What's your sense then of how this fits into the work that you've been doing on, for the want of a better description, drone policy?
Yeah, so I mean, this strike is pretty remarkable for a number of reasons. One, there was, a very swift sort of announcement that this attack had been quite successful, that we had taken out some ISIS-K fighters, that it prevented numerous terrorist attacks in the wake of the Kabul airport bombing. And so it was hailed as a success. But very quickly, non-governmental sources, the media, aid groups, families, individuals on the ground, were immediate in their questioning of the target and the fact that so many civilians, particularly children, had been killed. And there was, of course, a swift denial from the U.S. military at first, and then, as we know now, an investigation that ultimately found that a mistake had been made. So remarkably, we had an immediate celebration of the attack. We had a denial from the family involved of who the victims were. And then we had this turnaround and, very clear saying of fault, and that this was not the target that was intended. So the fact that this all happened in the last, 15, or now I guess it's almost a month, but 20 days is pretty remarkable in terms of speed, right? We've seen accusations of civilians killed by U.S. strikes previously, and denials, 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 and if the truth ever comes to light, it takes a very long time. So I think that's pretty remarkable. What's not remarkable is that we have another example of the use of lethal force against perceived threats not turning out as we had expected. And it really is business as usual, particularly as we think about it being 20 years since 9/11. We've seen the broad authorities to lethally target people around the world really expand under the last several administrations.
Well, what we know, and it's pretty sketchy, is that what the U.S. authorities thought was an ISIS-K car, which apparently matched a description of another one that they'd seen, it was at what they thought was an ISIS-K safe house of some, at least a place that they've been using. They saw them unloading stuff out of the trunk, loading stuff into the trunk, I should say, thinking they were explosives, when in fact they were apparently water containers. And then when the aid worker drove back to his home, unfortunately, all the children came out to greet him, and they were all victims of the Reaper drone strike and the secondary explosions that gave the U.S. confidence that they had struck the right person. And, of course, General Milley at the time described it as a righteous strike. That turned out to be propane bottles or tanks nearby that were ignited. So it's hard to know how all of those things could go wrong, but I guess given what had just happened prior to that, which is the suicide bombing that killed 13 U.S. soldiers and 169 Afghans, the U.S. authorities were pretty edgy, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I don't know what went wrong in terms of the intelligence. The report said that they followed the car for 8 hours, right? So they felt they had a reasonable degree of certainty that this was the target that they intended. And obviously, you know, in hindsight, we can see all of the steps and the signs of where things went wrong. The Trump administration made it much easier for individual drone operators to make those strike decisions as compared to the Obama White House, which had a larger bureaucracy. I am not sure what the chain of command was, what the rules of engagement were, who made those decisions, where did that intelligence get checked and briefed. You know, obviously, we can look now and say this was a horrific mistake. We don't know what the intelligence gatherers, the sensor operators, the pilots, what they had been observing, how that information was shared. And so really, this, you know, goes back to the larger policy of when do we use force? When is it okay to target people in other countries outside of war zones? If we have, you know, left and said we are no longer at war here in Afghanistan, but we reserve the right to use force, you know, there are serious questions about those decisions and the policy that goes into making those decisions. And it's not unique to Afghanistan. It's certainly something the U.S. is grappling with in the use of force around the world. And the most precise, as we saw, it was a very precise targeted strike. You know, one of the most precise weapons to do that are our drones and using those missile strikes.
And again, I'm speaking with Rachel Stoll, who's Vice President for Research Programs at the Stimson Center, where she focuses on issues relating to international arms trade, including small arms and light weapons, as well as children and armed conflict. She's the author of The International Arms Trade and The Beginner's Guide to the Small Arms Trade, and co-author of a report, recommendations and report of the Stimson's Task Force on U.S. Drone Policy, and a recent report, A New Agenda for U.S. Drone Policy and the Use of Lethal Force. So will what happened in Kabul, which we're talking about now, Rachel, how will that impact your most recent report, A New Agenda?
Yeah, so our most recent report outlined very specific recommendations that we would like to see the Biden administration take with regards to drone strikes and lethal drone policies. We also, in that report, had recommendations for Congress as well. This isn't really and should not solely be left up to the executive branch, that Congress has a very robust oversight role and needs to hold the executive branch accountable. You know, we really, in this report, we really recommended that the Biden administration take a step back, do a comprehensive strategic analysis and review of the U.S. program of lethal airstrikes and see whether or not these strikes have actually benefited U.S. national security. You can imagine the local blowback against the United States because of this strike, but it's certainly, there are global questions and the kind of international precedent that we are setting by making decisions to conduct strikes in this way certainly gives other countries a green light to act in the same way. We also encouraged the Biden administration to really look at their lethal force policy and ensure that they only use force such as drone strikes in countries where the United States is engaged in an armed conflict under strict criteria within the limits of both international humanitarian law and international human rights law. And frankly, we just don't know what the framework looks like in terms of how these decisions were made to know if that was a robust examination of the facts. You know, we've asked them to disclose all of the past policy positions, the legal interpretations, along with whatever their legal and policy analysis is on how the U.S. government has defined and interpreted legal and policy constraints on the use of force abroad. And that, again, would apply to this particular strike. I think there are a lot of lessons that we can learn, but really this strike is emblematic of the failure of U.S. lethal force policy over the last 20 years, where we, you know, had additional due diligence been undertaken. You know, it was very well known that this family worked for the U.S. military, as you mentioned, worked for an NGA and a U.S. aid organization, and had applied for visas to get out of the country because they'd been targeted by the Taliban. And so you wonder how in the 8 hours that was that this car was followed, how that information wasn't, or, you know, the address where he drove to, how that wasn't shared with the appropriate decision makers. So I think there's a lot of questions about how decisions are made, but the policies that and the legal interpretations that underlie those decisions.
So is it possible that given that the car was tracked by the drone and by the drone operator for 8 hours, it sort of reminds me of these TV car chases that you see on the news, particularly out here on the freeways in Los Angeles, where it sort of has a life of its own. Is that possible that after 8 hours, you just assume that this is the real thing because you've been watching it for so long?
Well, I mean, it's not just those two people, of course, right, that are watching the information. That information should and is usually shared amongst others. Obviously, if you're following it for 8 hours, you have a very specific, you know, task in mind. So that information was likely shared with a larger group of people. Now, who ultimately made the decision to fire, who ultimately was responsible for interpreting all of that intelligence, I don't know. But I would hope that there is, and we talk about this in our report as well, there has to be accountability for all decisions, you know, that are made, whether those are, you know, positive or have negative outcomes. There is, you know, the family, I think, has received some sort of conversation, but I hope that they receive consolation payments. I hope their visas are processed quickly and they're, you know, removed from Afghanistan. They're clearly at risk not only from the Taliban, but now for speaking out against the strike as well. And so hopefully there will be some accountability here and that these individuals will be treated with the humanity and respect they deserve.
And indeed, one of the deceased, of course, was an Afghan Army military officer who had worked with the U.S. as a translator, and they were all had papers to try and get out of the country, along with
exactly.
others. So just in the last few minutes, not so much changing the subject, but given that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs is in the crosshairs in this particular story about this drone strike that hit the wrong target, he's also featured in this new book by Bob Woodward and Robert Costa, and that's getting a lot of attention, the fact that apparently towards the end of Trump's tenure, he was concerned that Trump might do a kind of wag the dog situation and even put us on nuclear alert or even do something worse in order to distract from the fact that he'd lost the election. So he apparently, Milley apparently called his Chinese counterpart, I think at least at two occasions, and had lengthy conversation to assure him that if anything looks weird from our end, you know, ignore it. It's just,
yeah.
I mean, frankly, if you look at this situation from the point of view of the Russians and the Chinese, it's incredibly scary, and it makes us look like we're kind of somewhat reckless and dangerous. How does it strike you? Because I've spoken with Colonel Basevich a few times, and he wrote an article that sort of understood what Milley had his thinking process and thought, you know, it was obviously a good idea to avoid a nuclear war. Nobody would argue with that. But at the end of his article, he said he should also resign. So a lot of speculation out there. How does it strike you, Rachel?
Well, it is a lot of speculation, and I have to be honest, I'm not sure I have the all of the information to make an informed decision. But I do know that it was not business as usual throughout the Trump administration, that you had civil servants afraid of retaliation and retribution and, you know, did not speak freely. I know there were good people trying to protect the country and our security as much as they could. And I think there were very desperate measures that were taken. And I'll leave it to legal scholars and to those who are better versed in the appropriateness of General Milley's behavior to cast pass judgment on his actions. But I will say that I think the United States is very fortunate to have come out of 4 years of the Trump administration without being in worse shape than we are. I mean, you can see the amount of work across a whole range of issues, but particularly in the national security space, where so much damage has to be undone from the last 4 years. And you have, people really trying to figure out how to put a lot of our policies back together and to reestablish U.S. respect and good works around the world. And so I think, a lot of these stories are going to come out about people who had tried desperately to save the United States basically from itself during those 4 years.
And of course, President Trump has not gone away. He controls the Republican Party, and he congratulated those that showed up, only a handful, around 300, in the protests on Capitol Hill. So he is actively supporting insurrection, I think, is the only other way to put it. So it's an amazing situation to still have survived those 4 years, but the perpetrator is still loose, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of damage that's been done to this country in the last 4 years, and it's going to take more than the first 9 months of the Biden presidency to undo it. We have some major cultural shifts that are necessary in this country, some major political healing that's required, and we have to end this this partisanship that permeates every single thing that we do here in Washington. We have to think about what is actually best for the country and put our politics aside, check them at the door, and get down to the business of rebuilding this country.
Well, Rachel Stoll, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Rachel Stoll, who's a vice president for research programs at the Stimson Center, where she focuses on issues related to international arms trade, including small arms and light weapons, as well as children and armed conflict. She's the author of The International Arms Trade and The Beginner's Guide to the Small Arms Trade, and the co-author of a report, recommendations and report of the Stimson's Task Force on U.S. Drone Policy, and a recent report, A New Agenda for U.S. Drone Policy and the Use of Lethal Force.
We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into President Biden's call for a 30% cut in methane emissions by the end of the decade.
I could have burned your feet in the sand, but it all really doesn't matter at all. No, it all really doesn't matter at all. Life's a guess.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Joe Von Fischer, who's a professor of biology at Colorado State University, who studies methane emissions. His lab work in collaboration with the Environmental Defense Fund, and he uses the Google Street View cars to measure the leakage rate of natural gas from urban distribution systems around the country. Welcome to the Background Briefing, Joe Von Fischer.
Hi, Ian. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thanks for joining us. And on Friday, President Biden had a sort of virtual summit meeting with the leaders of the UK, the EU, Argentina, Bangladesh, Indonesia, South Korea, and Mexico, among others. And Biden pledged or urged world leaders to commit to cutting methane gas emissions by at least 30% below the 2020 levels by the end of the decade. I mean, I don't know whether this is doable, but it sounds like it's necessary. Is that the situation, that the first thing that you can get right to stop global warming is to tackle methane emissions?
Great question, Ian. There is an argument scientifically that methane is a great target. Methane only spends 10 years in the atmosphere after it's released as compared to carbon dioxide. And in those 10 years, methane has about 80 times potency as a greenhouse gas compared to CO2. So if you want to slow the rate of warming and have an immediate impact on the rate of warming, methane is an obvious first choice to tackle. It makes a lot of sense.
Well, of course, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is sounding the alarm. Recently, he said the world is on a catastrophic pathway to 2.7 degrees of heating And of course, there's a UN climate conference coming up in Glasgow, COP26, in the first week of November. President Biden, in response to the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's recent report in August, said that the report is code red for humanity. So it does seem that Biden gets it. What do you think happened with in those conversations? Obviously, we're speculating that he had with other world leaders who may not be quite as committed.
I hope that Biden acknowledged that the U.S. has an opportunity to serve as a leader in climate change work to reduce the rate of greenhouse gas emissions. So the U.S. not only is a leading source of greenhouse gas emissions, we're also a leading in the technology and in the scientific understanding of how greenhouse gases are emitted and how those emissions could be reduced. Ideally, the U.S. would step forward and commit to pledges. Ideally, the U.S. would share with the world technologies and approaches that can help reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And through this leadership, I hope it will convey to the world the importance of these actions.
Well, natural gas seems to be fairly ubiquitous in our lives, and methane is obviously a main component in natural gas, and it powers close to 40% of the U.S. electricity sector, and it enters the atmosphere through leakages in oil and gas wells, natural gas pipelines, etc., all the way up to the house itself. And I think probably most of our listeners have smelt leakage and had the gas company come at some point. So I know it's a difficult task, and you work on trying to kind of inventory the leakage. What part of the grid do you work on, Joe?
My work is on methane emissions from the distribution system. And if you break apart the overall structure of the natural gas system, you can think of the upstream end as happening where the oil and gas is extracted from the ground. And then that gas is purified to a degree, added to pipeline systems that crisscross the U.S. And other countries around the world. And those are distributed to cities and other end users. And within a city, there exists a distribution system that that delivers that natural gas to the homes and businesses where it's ultimately consumed. You know, one interesting story about broader reflects an earlier statement that you made, Ian, is it's interesting. About 10 or 15 years ago, people who were interested in climate change realized that if you burn coal versus if you burn methane, natural gas, that the amount of carbon dioxide released per amount of energy was lower if you burn methane because it has such a high energy content. And so there arose internationally this notion of clean burning natural gas. The idea that not only did you release less carbon dioxide, but with combustibles like coal, there were a number of secondary compounds like sulfur that led to sulfuric acid deposition and other problems environmentally. So the idea that methane and natural gas could be a bridge fuel that would help us get off coal was successful to a degree until we realized that these pipeline systems are leaky. And so if you have a leak rate between the oil and gas wellhead and the ultimate combustion and end use on the order of more than 5%, then because methane is such a potent greenhouse gas, it turns out that we'd actually be better off using coal, at least from a greenhouse gas perspective. And so that led to this, late in the last 5 or 10 years, this increased scientific interest, and as a result of policy interest, in finding where those gas leaks are and then doing something to abate them.
And again, I'm speaking with Joe Von Fischer, who's a professor of biology at Colorado State University, who studies methane emissions. His lab work, in collaboration with the Environmental Defense Fund, uses the Google Street View cars to measure the leakage rates of natural gas from urban distribution systems around the country. Now, let's talk a little bit about the work you do using the Google Street View cars, which, of course, provide people with the ability to look at any place on the world and any street, not in the entire world, but particularly here in the United States. So the idea that we have about 2 million miles of natural gas pipelines, and then I don't know whether anybody's done the inventory on the number of miles of pipelines into the house to the gas stove or the gas water heater, but that's got to be extraordinary. So at every step on the way, there's leakage. So tell me about the equipment you use and what you detect.
Yeah, Ian, it's a really interesting problem because we have long understood about greenhouse gas emissions in where there are universities and where the scientists live. What was really great about being able to work on the Google Street View platform is that the Google Street View cars would go everywhere. They went into all kinds of neighborhoods, all kinds of cities, all kinds of places where we had a much weaker understanding of where greenhouse gases like methane were coming from. And from my perspective, this led to something like the democratization of information about where greenhouse gas emissions are happening. And we discovered that using an improved technology for looking for greenhouse gas emissions and leak sources, that we were finding about 2.5 times more leaks than the gas companies were using their traditional technology. The technology we used involved a generation of methane analyzers, and these methane analyzers use what's called laser absorption spectroscopy to measure methane concentration with really high precision. These devices are really cool from my perspective. I was always a big fan of Mr. Spock as a kid. And from my view, these devices acted a lot like the tricorder, being able to make high precision, real-time measurements of methane concentration that then we can trace back to where the natural gas leaks are happening. So for about 7 years, we had a set of methane analyzers deployed on 4 Google Street View cars that were crisscrossing the country. And in that time, we measured the methane concentrations and related those to natural gas leaks across 16 different cities in the U.S. And in a recent paper with my colleague Zach Weller from Colorado State University and Steve Hamburg from Environmental Defense Fund, we came to estimate that there are about 630,000 natural gas leaks in the U.S. distribution system at any given time throughout the year, and that this leads to about 5 times more methane being emitted from the distribution system than the current EPA estimates had in the books.
Well, that's incredibly alarming. So does this mean, though, at the end of the day, we really have to have a national debate on whether or not we should get rid of our gas stoves, gas water heaters, etc.?
It is an ongoing debate, and I think people are starting to realize that the use of methane and natural gas, either fossil fuel natural gas or even discussions about so-called green natural gas, that is gas that's developed biogenically from waste sort of cellulosic or other materials that are fermented. There are a variety of ways that you can generate methane between those two pathways. And the question is, can we keep it all in the pipeline and can we prevent it from entering the atmosphere? If the answer is unequivocally yes, then I think there exists a pathway for us to continue using natural gas or methane sources as an energy source. A lot of people think that's not going to be possible and that it might be better off if we started to make the switch towards alternative ways of heating and powering our homes and businesses. Already we know that solar and wind are viable players in this space. There's some interesting discussion about nuclear as being a sustainable fuel. Certainly it's low CO2 emission, but it, as we know, has other consequences. But there are other viable pathways, like what about geothermal heating and cooling to homes and businesses? Could we use a similar infrastructure to what natural gas companies are currently using to bring energy to homes? And could they switch over to a geothermal type of delivery system? And already there are some natural gas distribution companies that are exploring that. Moreover, when there are energy companies that provide both electrical and natural gas to the city, and it's a combined utility infrastructure, some of those utilities are looking to, instead of replacing leaky natural gas lines, they're considering retiring them or moving to the geothermal ideas that I talked about before. Some homes don't get enough power through electricity to allow a wholesale switch off of natural gas towards electric. That is, a grid system that supplies that energy to homes simply isn't powerful to deliver that much energy to homes in, let's say, upstate New York, where there are cold winters and there's just not enough local electric supply. There, I think we're on a longer-term track to wean ourselves off of fossil fuels. But for many other parts of the country, it's a viable pathway to think about using electrical or other sustainable energy sources to power to homes.
Well, there's also, of course, the suggestion that we need to decentralize generation. And if each home had solar or wind and had a battery storage, which I believe Tesla's working on, at the end of the day, that makes more sense than using these overburdened grids.
It certainly could. That debate goes all the way back to Nikola Tesla and Thomas Edison, who had various notions of how energy should be supplied, locally or centrally. And Edison won with a dominance of AC power in our current delivery system. But Tesla's idea had a lot of merit: local supply, local delivery. I think we'll see that debate continue to swing backwards and forwards over time as one technology swings over power. We can also imagine a situation where banks of energy are stored at a central distribution system, and then that energy is delivered over a long term throughout the grid. The energy grid, the electric grid, that is, that supplies electricity to homes and businesses throughout the country, is a piece of infrastructure that is remarkably fragile, as we saw in the case of Texas during the recent catastrophes. Where electric distribution grids are weakened or become overwhelmed, like California during recent heat-related blackouts. The electric grid is a complex entity that is much more fragile than I think a lot of people realize. And there's a lot of under the scenes or behind the scenes action to understand how to strengthen and make more robust and resilient our nation's electric grid. I think those are conversations that could likewise come into the public domain and receive a little bit more support and development than they're getting right now.
So just in closing, back to Biden's call with the leaders of a number of countries on Friday, pledging to reduce greenhouse gas emissions globally by at least 30% below 2020 levels by the end of the decade. And it's quite a challenge. And in this $3.5 trillion budget bill that seems to be stalled, apparently there is money. Actually, there's a part of it is to pass a new methane fee as part of the $3.5 trillion budget bill. So tell us about that, because I think, you know, you talked about how it was much touted as a bridge fuel to get us off coal, but then it turns out that so much methane leakage that it may be a wash, you know, in fact, maybe worse off, because fracking, I think, has opened up all kinds of fissures around. And I'm not sure that all of the leakage from fracking has even been quantified. So just a quick summary at the end here, if you will, Joe, in terms of where the legislation's heading and what kind of practical things to reach President Biden's goal are in the pipeline.
Yeah, Ian, here's what I would say, there are existing a number of legislative proposals on the table to try to minimize the climate impacts of methane. One of them, as mentioned, is trying to set up a fee system or tax, if you will, on the movement and purchase and delivery of methane through the nation's pipeline systems. Another one that's relatively more advanced are technologies existing at a number of scales to find natural gas leaks. And I would say that those legislative moves are relatively advanced compared to carbon or methane taxes. So that is the idea of a mandate requiring the use of advanced leak detection technologies has already been passed, even under the Trump administration, under the Department of Transportation, Pipeline Hazards and Safety Administration's PIPES Act, which required the use of advanced leak detection technologies to find natural gas leaks, estimate their size, and prioritize those repairs primarily. It's my hope that that sort of effort will find and reduce emissions from natural gas point sources. There are now satellites up in the air. There are drones and airplanes. There are cars and there are walking devices that cumulatively have the potential to find and reduce natural gas leaks a lot. That, I think, is one pathway. I think when you put pressure on one end, you have to find an alternative source of energy to allow people to switch to. Those pathways are also opening up into the Biden budget, and I'm excited to see the combination of pressure and new opportunities will drive an overall change in our nation's energy infrastructure, one that reduces our overall greenhouse gas footprint.
Well, Joe Von Fischer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much, Ian, for inviting me. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
And likewise, and again, I've been speaking with Joe Von Fischer, who is a professor of biology at Colorado State University, who studies methane emissions. His lab works in collaboration with the Environmental Defense Fund, and they use the Google Street View cars to measure the leakage rate of natural gas from urban distribution systems around the country. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon. If you missed any of today's program or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And we also encourage you to rate and review us on those platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. To help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all, please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. Now that I have resigned from Pacifica, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing at backgroundbriefing.org. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305.